Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside, Baseball Prospectus' dedicated website covering the Chicago White Sox in this post-All-Star Break episode, which you can find on iTunes by searching the Catbird Speaks. You know, if you want to subscribe for future episodes in a different way, however you found this episode, that'd be the place to go. Also, check out Blog Talk Radio. We have a page on it. Search for the Catbird Speaks. Today, I'm James Fegan, joining you from Elkhart, Indiana, the RV capital of the world. Joining us from Manhattan on vacation is Nick Schaefer.
Hey. I didn't quite catch that. It's the Elkhart's the capital of what?
The RV capital of the world.
Oh. For a second, I heard Arby's and got kind of excited, too.
I live next to an Arby's.
You're just living the dream, man.
Yeah. Maybe we could probably get Heyman as the next guest on the podcast.
Yeah, you could have him in studio out there.
Hoping there's no conflict between BP and FanRag Sports that I don't know about.
Nothing that can't be smoothed over with, what is it, horsey sauce or whatever they have at Arby's?
I don't know, and I don't want to find out. Nick, are you staycationing in Manhattan?
Yeah, Jane's still got work this week, and I haven't had any free time in New York in the summer for years now, so I'm just kind of living it up. I mean, I'm starting a new gig Monday, which is might be pretty intense, and I want to be fresh and ready to go. So, yeah, staycation.
Full-time writer for BP Southside, right?
Yeah. I mean, they offered, you know, tip out there for people who are looking at careers. BP Southside is paying me seven figures a year to write for them. So it's a great gig if you can get it.
Which the fact that they still kept me part-time on like a few hundred dollars a month as editor, well, they offered you that threw me a bit, but I'm going to learn to live with it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It would match some of the remuneration that's done at other sports media outlets, right?
Perhaps.
I'm loud. I'm offensive. I'm opinionated. I get the big bucks.
I guess they don't, when they were trying to compensate you for your MLB TV subscription, they did not estimate the right price.
Yeah, they just said fill in the blank, and hey, we haven't gotten audited yet.
but the White Sox are two games over at the break. They just sent, I guess they're two All-Star worthy players to the All-Star game, like you do. I kind of had like this meager goal for them for the last 2 weeks of the break, was that they could enter the All-Star break four games over if they just split between the Yankees and Astros and dominated two awful teams, the Twins and Braves. And they exceeded my expectations by taking the road series against the Astros and then screwed up my scenario by failing to win a series at home against the Braves, where they had Sale and Quintana. It was kind of amazing. Also, they got, 7 2/3 and two earned from James Shields, who can't strike anyone out anymore. So that's a significant hindrance to kind of be working through.
Yeah, I was at the Sale and Quintana games in Houston visiting family, so we went out to the games, and it was really fun. Minute Maid's a pretty nice park. I like that. For even though when the roof's closed, they still get a lot of natural light in there because they have this big sort of glass wall in the direction of sun exposure. Really good place to take in a game.
See, you would have an opinion that when they're playing the White Sox, they should have the roof closed. Is that like an important thing for them?
Like strategically? Or, I mean, it was comfortable because it was 95 degrees out, and instead it was, you know, inside the stadium with the roof closed. It was considerably less than that. But it's kind of been, this little stretch has been sort of a microcosm of the season as a whole, in a way. Because, you know, 45 and 43, like if I told you that before the season, you would kind of be like, yeah, that makes sense, right?
That makes sense, but I probably wouldn't be very encouraged.
No, but if every projection system, or most of them did, had the White Sox somewhere winning between, what, 80 and 84 games or something like that, then, you know, here you are. That's kind of what this team is. Obviously, the way they've gotten here has been vexing. Is that the right word?
That'd be correct. I guess also, like, kind of the thing with their projections is that they're kind of projected to just miss the playoffs. And the Indians are supposed to be this dominant hegemony, or hegemony, I'm not pronouncing. Why did I use this word I can't pronounce?
You have a reading vocabulary.
I very much do. So you're kind of hoping that Bakota is way overselling that and slightly underselling the White Sox, or the White Sox are going to significantly change their roster in a meaningful way over the course of that time. Instead, you have the Indians, probably a little flukily, because I still don't believe that they're at... I don't believe the reasons that they're projected to be as strong as they were preseason.
Right.
But they're still hitting it, so you got to give them that. And then you have the White Sox, who are both hitting their projections, not over them, and have not reshaped the roster in a meaningful way to make them think that they're better than they are.
Yeah.
So, shit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at Cleveland, and I'm just going down the list of things that look sustainable or real or whatever it is. I mean, Yan Gomes having an OPS of 516, that's... I think that if that had happened, that they'd be in real trouble. They're getting a typical Rajay Davis season, like 24 steals to 3 caught stealing.
Supposed to still get a typical Rajay Davis season when he's 35, though.
Yeah, well, you know, they got it. And they actually tried, and I wrote 2,000 words on this, and I probably could have written more. I might even go back in there now before it gets published and add some more, because I'm just looking at this roster, and I'm seeing, like, you know, Rajay Davis, Marlon Byrd, Abe Almonte wound up getting suspended or whatever. But they did the sort of whole aggressive, like, throw a lot of mediocrity, you know, like, at the walls, at their problems, and maybe they'd stick. And they actually, you know, got something quite usable out of Rajay Davis. They got 130 pretty good plate appearances out of Marlon Byrd. As opposed to what the White Sox have done, which is absolutely nothing. They've just, I don't want to basically read the article to everybody here on the air, but it's fascinating because on the pitching side, the White Sox have been fairly aggressive about pursuing options to solve problems, right? Like, they DFA'd Danks, they brought in Latos in spring training, they brought in Miguel Gonzalez as soon as he became available, even when Latos was doing well. They traded for James Shields. Even for, you go further down, like you look into Charlotte, you know, they added Jacob Turner over the offseason. They brought in Anthony.
I don't know. I'm giving him credit for that, since it seems like a bad idea.
And like Anthony Renato, too, who I've been on the record for years as being like, I don't get how Anthony Renato's, like, I sort of attributed it to Red Sox prospect type that anybody even knew his name. Because once he, I mean, he was good in college, then he got hurt, and then he slid in the draft, and he's been bad ever since. But, like, you can see what I'm saying. They had, like, one or two spots in the rotation that they were worried about at a given time, and they added a bunch of conceivably functional players. Whereas, on the other side of the ball, you have Abascal, you know, in the top, what is he, top five in plate appearances on the team or something like that? At DH,
how could that be?
Getting worse and worse. I could check. Getting worse and worse, it seems, by the week. No, sorry, he's sixth in plate appearances on the team.
Huh.
And it's like, where are the similar, you know, scrap heap dice roll guys? Like, I'm not even saying, you know, well, why don't you just sign, you know, Mike, why don't you just trade for Mike Trout? I'm not doing that. I'm not being that guy. I'm just saying, like, this is an anchor around your neck, and you're not even trying to fix it. I mean, they signed Morneau when he still had a month. He was still a month away, and we don't, like, Morneau may not work. But if there's, I don't even know if they've signed him and thought, well, when he does come back, problem is solved. We don't need to address this anymore. Because when you try to solve a problem with one of these fringe bargain bin guys, you need to grab a lot, because most of them are going to fail. There's a reason they're in that little, you know, their bargain bin in the first place.
Sands would be your example of a bargain guy that they tried out.
Yeah, you need like eight of those.
Sands has a 236, 276, 291 line with a 400 BABIP.
He had a K rate over 40%, which is unreal. You know, obviously they've had some bad luck with, you know, like call ups, like, you know, like Matt Davidson and Kevin Smith playing, getting like two plate appearances combined before they got hurt. But, you know, the examples I give in the article are James Loney and Robbie Grossman. And that's not to say, you know, with just with the benefit of hindsight, that of all the waiver ads people have made this offseason or this during this year, like, aha, these are the two best ones. You should have done these. And, you know, I was stumping for Loney as soon as the Rays DFA'd him. But at the same time, you know, if you don't ever try these guys from the bargain bin, like, you never expose yourself to the possibility of getting catching one of these guys who are, you know, a post hype prospect or a or somebody who's going to decline more gently than we thought in the form of Loney.
Or just a, you know, 200, 300 PA dead cat bounce.
Yeah, anything. And frankly, it's just, I'm trying to figure out what it is. If it's that they just consistently overestimate Abascal's ability. If it's denial, like, I don't get it. Certainly, I mean, it's, James Loney was, you know, these and Grossman are cost $0. I mean, I guess they picked up Slade Heathcott. But he's never, I mean, that isn't a major league guy. Slade Heathcott's a post-hype prospect who, yeah, he's gotten off to a good start in Charlotte, but we're talking about like five games.
Bourgeois, I guess.
Yeah, I don't, but do you know what I mean? Am I making sense? I'm just confused at the inaction in that particular area.
You'd think that we'd have a longer name of list of failures and churn that they're going through, given how bad the return has been.
Yeah, I mean, they when I was in Houston, they were DHing. They flipped Avila and Navarro DHing, which was kind of ironic given that last year Soto was one of the team's like best hitters, particularly against lefties, and Ventura was terrified of even like pinch hitting with him.
Yeah. Navarro's been real bad, but I guess if you were going to give Avila that... If you were going to give Avila like a day off catching, he'd be a better bat than what you have. Which
oh, Narvaez? Or, oh, you mean Avila?
Yeah.
Sorry, Garcia.
And Chuck.
Yeah, it was looking for a while. Like, and frankly, Avila's kind of worked out. Has been better than you'd expect. This is his best year since 2012.
I mean, it's really limited PAs still at this point because he's strained his hamstring twice. And
yeah,
but at least I guess the positive thing is like you concerned, like looking at his power dissipating last year, like that ability to go to walk was going to go away once we realized that you could just put it in the zone and he would take walks. But he's really just that good at taking walks. Watching
yeah,
close.
It's a real skill. And I'm just going to assume it's there until it's proven that it's not right. I mean, you kind of have to even it's like how little power and contact you have to hit for before they stop walking. And it's like, well, we haven't found it yet. So Chuck is at this point comfortably out hitting Abascal. And frankly, even if they were hitting the same, Chuck has an articulable set of skills that you can use and defend him being on a roster. You know, if he's your 24th, 25th man, like he can play center field. He's not great, but he can.
Chuck is Abascal's plate approach with more pull power.
Oh my God. I mean, he does have, 80 points of slugging on him right now.
Yes.
But yeah. So like Chuck shouldn't be the first guy on the chopping block. I think it has to be Abascal at this point. I mean, at a certain point, do you just DH like Carlos Sanchez or something? Like, what do you do?
Maybe. Sanchez has really been extremely terrible in his limited auditions.
Yeah.
But
he's so good at AAA, though, dude.
Well,
he wasn't. Actually,
so was Jordan Danks.
Actually, he wasn't this year. What is Jordan Danks doing?
I don't think he's in active baseball.
Maybe he's in Asia somewhere.
Things somehow deteriorated after he left the White Sox.
He had four PAs with the Phillies last year.
He was awful for the AAA team. Like,
went over. Yeah.
Imagine his AAA manager was like calling up the GM, like, "You got to give me something better."
Oh, and he looks a little the worse for wear in his BR photo as well. So Yeah, that's, you know, you can read my magnum opus about this topic if I haven't already made myself clear on my just absolute befuddlement as to how this is like the best they can do.
So clearly from what I've heard, you know, they definitely recognize Avisail is bad. I think they probably were in the 95th percentile on expectations of him going in than like the rest of humanity. And that's its own mistake. I think they're pretty clearly waiting for Renault to be ready to finally cut ties or at least move him out of regular appearances. But that's kind of a bad idea since I don't see Renault's performance right now and think like, oh, this guy's toast. I see this as like, this is a 35-year-old guy in spring training, basically, against guys who are playing full season. So the kind of expectation for him to be rapidly ready was always kind of bizarre.
Well, and the other thing, too, is, you know, we've seen, like, Avila's might be a good comp in this respect where he's very injury-prone. He was on the DL when they signed him. There's a lot of ifs here. There's the if he can play well. There's the, you know, if he can play well, when's that going to start? And
that's so grating to me.
And can he even stay on the field? But then is it the type of thing where they signed him and it's like, well, we solved the problem. You just got to wait a month or two.
6 weeks!
Yeah, it's...
And then he might not be ready. Like, I wouldn't call him up tomorrow.
No, I mean, I guess there is that question of how bad does he have to be before he's not an upgrade on Avisail, but that's kind of like none of these excuses or explanations make you look any better. Cause it's like, oh man, well, you know, we'd love to trade for somebody, but the market's just not, you know, there's just people aren't willing to sell at this point. It's just like, yeah, this happens every year. Like these teams that are dead have every incentive to wait and for more bidders or till they get a price that they like. And they're in no hurry other than maybe like, I don't know if the Yankees had, let's say the Yankees went on like an L10 and just like crashed and decided to sell on Beltran. Like you might be a little anxious to trade him just in case he like gets hurt and you get nothing for him. But other than that, a lot of these teams can just, you know what, like the Braves aren't going to be in any less a last place in 2 weeks than they are now. They can afford to have, you know, a bidding war, whatever it is, over whatever it is they're trying to sell, whatever that may be. I mean, so saying the fact that they were saying like, oh, well, we'll fix this at the trade deadline was always
bad,
asinine at best.
Because they're kind of just like in where you'd want to be, I guess, where they're floating above 500. But that only really works in like a really bad down year. And I don't think the American League is having a year where like everybody's just running away with absurd win totals. I think it's just pretty typical. I mean, the idea that you wouldn't expect like the division race, like you can't just perpetually think it's going to be like 90 wins or even less.
Well, the other thing, too, is when you have four teams of comparable quality coming into the season, or at least four teams that can credibly compete, like, yeah, you can hope that some of them underperform, but to cross your fingers and hope that all of them underperform is insane. And that's not a strategy. That's just, like, hoping to get struck by lightning, and in which case you might as well not, you know what I mean? Like if that's your plan, it doesn't really matter what you do because you're just hoping that you get your 99th percentile outcome. And to an extent, they have gotten the luck that they needed. Like there have been so many injuries to key players to division rivals throughout this year, like way worse. Like the White Sox have lost, I don't know, like Avila and Austin Jackson. Like every other rival has lost like multiple all-stars for significant periods of time. So like you've had your luck.
Losing Putnam hurts when you have like no bullpen depth.
Yeah, but like he's not Michael Brantley.
No,
he's not Alex Gordon. He's not Mike Moustakas. He's not Jordan Zimmerman. He's not Carlos Carrasco.
And he isn't.
And I love Zach Putnam. This is coming from me, man. I'm Zach Putnam's number one fan. Putnam. And I've been Zach Putnam's number one fan for since the moment they acquired him.
I've been calling him K God for the last year and a half.
K-Rod, but a deity.
Yeah.
I guess there's still that befuddling sort of split where the White Sox are on, a 90-win pace against everybody who's not Cleveland, Detroit, or Kansas City? And then they're the Cleveland Spiders against those three teams?
Yeah, which I think a generous thing is to say that's variance. Because the only way to, take it seriously is to be like, well, you built the fourth worst team in the division and are having that proven to you.
Yeah, but, they've done, for example, they've gone 6-5 against Boston and Baltimore, who are good teams, 3-3 against Houston, 2-3 against the Mets, 5-1 against Toronto, 4-2 against Texas. They've played good teams well. I'm cherry picking to prove that point. I mean, there've been other, these are all random tiny little splits. So I don't think it's as simple as being those three teams are better, therefore they post a 75% winning percentage against the White Sox. I don't think that, it probably is just flukiness, but it has been sort of a consistent trait over the years.
I want to write it out to flukiness, because otherwise I'm just going to write it up to something unnecessarily and possibly incorrectly damning. What else would you think the reason is? Familiarity with Sale and Quintana or something like that? Familiarity with Robin's tactics and they just pants him every time or what?
Yeah, I don't think the manager has that much of an influence on outcomes. And you're right. I can't really think of anything causal. I mean, the Indians, I could think of specific players who matched up well against what the White Sox did. The Indians always did a good job of stocking lefty mashers, for example, to sort of try to combat Sale Quintana. Ryan Rayburn is the famous example. The Indians also have a couple of pitchers who...
They had a beautiful approach against him in the U.S. Cellular game where they knocked him around.
They've had a number of excellent games against Sale, I feel like. But they also have guys Trevor Bauer's weakness for forever was he would walk everybody if you let him, but the White Sox are too dumb to just put their bats on their shoulders. So every time they face Bauer, he destroys them. Or Josh Tomlin, whose only weakness is home runs, but the White Sox didn't have any power, so he could just cruise also. So those were the types of things that I could point to as possible causes. But no, I can't think of it unless there's some sort of ineffable idea of they have a book on the White Sox and the White Sox don't have an equal book on these opponents that they're playing. What do they play, 18 times a year each? 19 times a year each?
18 and 19, yeah.
Which theoretically would make sense to put more effort into figuring out those teams than the teams you play, a third of that amount.
Right.
But I don't know.
Probably could just be fixed with more talent. Just
thinking. Yeah. You replace Avisail Garcia with James Loney and probably had a couple more wins to this point.
You know what I was saying about 200, 300 PA type of flyers or bench guys or something like that?
Yeah.
That's 'cause I was kind of hoping Austin Jackson would be, not everyday center fielder.
You mean their premier free agent?
Yeah, the biggest free agent signing of the offseason.
Yeah, that was frustrating. That was a big frustrating part of the offseason, which played out in slow motion, and you were just, as it was happening, you were no way are they still gonna do their usual thing where they don't get anybody, and lo and behold, they did. So,
I mean, not as a Cubs jealousy thing, but kind of just last year, you watched with a good team, how they assessed Austin Jackson. It was this is a good guy to have on the bench and, start for a week or so if somebody gets hurt or pulls a hamstring. And then the White Sox turn around and, just install him.
Yeah, he's a great, most teams have players like that to protect, to insulate them. They're the extra layer of defense between your starting guy like your plan A guy, and you're like cannon fodder in AAA. And we've seen what that looks like. That's Jerry Sands. That's Jason Coates. Guys where if you're playing them, it's like everything went wrong. But the White Sox have those guys as like plan A and plan B. And, you know, if they even have a plan B, sometimes those plan B guys become plan A, and then there's just a dive into you're back to Coates again. In a way, like, it's miraculous they have even Shuck, because Shuck is hanging around at 700 OPS and like playing functional defense in center. Like, that is so much better than some of the, you know, the guys they've turned to, the Ray Omedos of the world. That they've turned to in the past.
Yeah. That's just like, without that layer of like large investment for big time free agents or overpaying to make sure that you have an above average talent and maybe having to pay someone like an elite talent just to make sure that you have like something that's consistent producing, they've just peeled away a layer of defense where all like their nice bench guys are second division starters and all their org depth are their nice bench guys, and then their, you know, deli meat slicers are their org depth, and then ex-convicts are the deli meat slicers, and the deli runs out of money because people are shortening the register. And it...
I feel like it would be appropriate for me to chime in, but I kind of want to just let you keep going.
I know what I said.
I want you to get to the chuds and stuff.
PC about, you know, recidivism and defensivism and all that, but...
Oh, I'd like to think it's more an indictment on the system than the individuals involved, right?
Yeah, if they got these people, like, real jobs instead of working for the White Sox theoretical deli.
The White Sox theoretical deli has got to be the title, right?
Of this podcast?
Yeah, I'm going to write that. I guess since it's already, you know, mid-July and they haven't done anything, they were holding out for someone big. Is that crazy? I mean, they kind of used their LaRoche money already.
What, Shields?
Yeah, Shields is a lot of it. He's almost certainly not opting out at this point.
I mean, he could be very reckless and confident. They get such a good deal on that. Like, acting like that's a hamstringing, like, financial burden.
Oh, yeah.
Mother of God.
Yeah, they owe him, what, 10 of each of the next 2 years?
I mean, they owe him 27 overall. It's like some reduced amount this year and something.
Yeah, it's $21 million each of the next 2 years, and the Padres are paying $11 million each of those years. So it's 10 a year for the next 2 years.
Their freaking opening day payroll is $114 million.
Yeah. They've had two payrolls over 100, opening day payrolls over $120 million in history, if I'm not mistaken.
Has there been two?
Yeah, I think 2011 was one of them.
All right, 2011 is their biggest in 2008. 2008 resulted in a playoff trip. I don't know.
Yeah.
Someone might want to take something away from that.
it's. I feel like a broken record at this point, but I don't really have... You know what I mean? It's so weird. Like,
who makes the playoffs and then cuts $25 million in payroll?
No? Was that a rhetorical question?
Well, the White Sox do. That's what they did, right, in 2009. But
it's a
weird response, in my opinion.
I'm trying to think of an analogy. It's just, it's like watching somebody drive with a flat tire for, like, you know, days and days at a time. It's like, do they hear that? Can they feel like it messing with their steering and stuff like that? They don't need to get, like, the best tire in the world. Just, you know, like, one that'll get them to their next... to their destination, right? I'll come up with some better analogy, maybe something more graphic.
So their bullpen's like egregiously bad.
Yeah, and that's even with Zach Duke bouncing back.
I mean, not with like performance. I think like their overall totals are still like top 10.
Well, that's partially because Jennings has an ERA under 2, with a strikeout to walk ratio of 1.26.
His inheritance rate could not be good. It's not so much like, oh, this bullpen is like actively killing them all the time. It's just like you look at it and you see like three or four guys who are just like not usable in any kind of like remotely like even medium or leverage situation. Like you can't put Matt Albers out there. He's getting shelled every time. Michael Yanoa, you know, I like him, but he's not ready. Chris Beck was getting nothing done. They just like got rid of him. And Dan Jennings, I wouldn't really put him in any situation. He's not particularly effective against lefties, and his peripherals are terrible.
The only thing he does, he's done well this year, is he's kept the ball in the park. Like, he's done that.
Right.
But, no, his strikeout-to-walk ratio is really bad. You have, oh, geez, yeah,
look at this. He's allowing 46% of inherited runners to score.
I don't know if, that's real bad. I don't know yes. Whether these splits are messed up the same way the position player splits are on FanGraphs, but it has the White Sox as sixth in the majors in FIP for relievers.
I mean, that's consistent with what I've heard. Like, they're fine.
I guess part of that is just that, like, you know. Well, I mean, I guess that. I mean, that's Duke, Jones, and Robertson. Like, Duke's FIP is pretty.
You had a month of Albers pitching his face off. Factored in there.
Yeah, but he gave all that back, though, right? I mean, that's...
I mean, yes, and... Yes.
But you have... Part of that is the 27 innings of Putnam striking out 9.9 per 9, as per usual. And that's gone. You don't have that anymore.
He's trying to play catch this week.
Oh, bless his heart.
Bless his elbow. Needs it. He literally didn't complain until, like, oh, well, the whole thing where I can't feel my fingers is resulting in me walking a lot of guys. So I guess it's an issue.
What's scary about that is that was a symptom. Wasn't that one of the giveaway symptoms that Harvey had thoracic outlet syndrome?
Right.
Was numbness in his hand. Certainly hope that's not the case for our boy Zach.
I mean, they think it's elbow inflammation.
I mean, that didn't stop Harvey from completely shutting the White Sox down when they faced him. But, you know, right. Whatever.
John Danks had that fun stretch where he couldn't feel his fingers.
Ugh. I try not to think about him at this point.
You and 29 teams.
The thing with that is... It's hard. Like, I don't want to kill the team for this, though. Like, it's a problem. But most teams, if they lost their third and fourth best relievers, right-handed relievers to injury, would be in a bind, right?
It's not so much like, oh, I'm not going to say this bullpen is poorly constructed because I don't think it is. And I think you can't really underrate. I mean, I'm really, really low on Webb. But I think those two guys just going down is kind of the reason you're seeing so much like org depth bubbling to the top.
I find Danish and Beck to be weird choices. I mean, obviously this, you know, I'm trying to avoid talking about Ventura because my thoughts on his strategies are well known. At least if you're listening to this podcast, I assume you know how I feel about it. But I will say, it's not just that they've had those guys up, which is strange because especially Danish, theoretically, they think he has some sort of future with the organization and the majors and probably back to some extent. But they're like, they're getting like tattooed in like the minors. So like you're messing with their development in a sense.
Beck, I understand a bit more because he really hasn't missed bats. And when he came out of the bullpen and threw 95, that's probably the most interested I've been in Chris Beck in his entire time with the organization.
But has he been throwing out of the bullpen in the minors?
No.
So why? If you're going to make him a reliever, don't do that conversion experiment in the majors.
Oh well, yeah, that's not ideal.
So do that. Fine. If you've given up on him as a starter, which hey, fair. He's like he can't get guys out in AAA. Like, go for it. Like if his velocity actually ticks up like that. Maybe you have something there. Let him try it out. You know, like let him figure that out. Don't like bring him in like a close game. And like I'm really fascinated too. Like, I want to see what the leverage index is for the relievers that Ventura uses the day before or like the day after they get called up or sent down. Because he loves doing that. Yeah. Was being like, listen, I have confidence in you to come in this like bases loaded two run game, and then it's like, oh well, you know, you were like the 18th man in the bullpen over the course of the year, and like we're sending you down tomorrow. So you're like, what?
I'm trying to look up what Will Omen's sign off was, because I'm pretty sure it's his last major league innings of his career.
Will Omen. Chris Beck does have a pretty solid Twitter account there. Watch your Beck. It's pretty good.
It's a good handle. I'll say that much.
You know, I haven't looked at the full pitching staff in Charlotte, but I just feel like if you're doing that, you could pick better guys for those reasons I said. Beck should be, if you want him to learn to be your reliever, great, have him do it in Charlotte. Danish, if you think he's a complete non-prospect, don't, then whatever, but like, don't do this to him if he is a prospect in your mind. Philippe Aumont retired, right?
Philippe who? Oh, yes, oh. Yes.
Excuse you, the main return for the first Cliff Lee trade or whatever, Philly.
I don't know how I was saying his name in my head, but it wasn't that.
I mean, I'm trying to think of, wouldn't you rather, okay, like, and this is, you know, we're talking about, this is definitely a deck chairs on the Titanic situation, this conversation, but like, I don't know.
Wouldn't be a sports podcast if it wasn't.
Like, Cam Lowe has been a good major league.
Oh, God.
Hold on. He's been a good major league reliever in his career. It's been a while, but he's done it, right? And he's actually had 10 really good innings in Charlotte. Like, he's striking a lot of dudes out. He's not walking anybody. If you're going to get, like, an eighth man in the pen or, like, a seventh, eighth man in the pen, why are you sending your 21 or 22-year-old from AA up to do it, who's getting bad results in AA? Why don't you take this, like, journeyman reliever guy? That's what they're for, right?
You would think.
Because at least he's like, you're not messing with something that you theoretically care about. And it might get better results just short term.
Maybe, he's terrible.
Yeah, right.
I was looking at AAA relievers like, what has Chris Volstead got behind his arm?
Are you getting like apocalypse level rain right now?
Yeah.
It's loud.
I could shut the door.
Nah, it's soothing.
My bird feeder is gonna get ruined.
We already have a title for this episode. Stop doing that.
I guess they just signed Ryan Webb. That'd be kind of the throwing stuff against the wall. But it's a little late. Tally Canley, they're probably hoping he wouldn't be like, you know, functionally useless.
Well, God, they really threw him in to the fire on the city.
I guess I'm better off just not bringing him up.
So I've decided now that I'm all aboard the Slade Heathcott train to totally pivot out of still stay in Charlotte, but pivot back to the offensive side of the ball.
That Charlotte pitching staff is not good.
No. Well, they've it's bad. But Slade Heathcott was actually once a very real prospect, I think, right?
He
was a BA top 100 guy. He was number six.
Better or worse than Greg Golson, who the White Sox have also claimed from the Yankees in the past?
I don't remember Greg Golson, so I'm going to say better. But I don't know. Heathcott's one of those. He's definitely got an interesting personal life. Like, background, he grew up in a very chaotic situation, so it would be I don't know, triumph over adversity type story if he made it to the majors and got something done. I mean, I think he was like super athletic. I think he had a lot of injury problems and doesn't look like his stat lines were that great in the minors, but off to a great start in Charlotte. And gonna bring it back to this, he could be better than Avi.
I'm not holding my breath.
So, with Avila down again, is Kevin Smith alive yet?
He's rehabbing in the Arizona Rookie League.
Oh, jeez. Poor guy. But, you know, this got me thinking just when I was looking at it, you know, we're worried now, right? Like, what the hell are you going to do with catcher? It's like Navarro, who's not exactly tearing it up. And then, I don't know, the guys who are just like 5% better than Adrian Nieto or whatever Narvaez is. But what are you doing at catcher next year?
That's highly dependent on what you're doing in general. I imagine you're on the free agency market.
Yeah, I guess you're just grabbing scrappy dudes again, right?
If you are complete fire sale rebuilding, I guess you're starting whoever you got from the sale trade.
If you're talking about that scenario, then you're already talking about turnover of like,
you know, Blake Swihart, 2017, baby.
Oh, God. I'm like getting to the point where I want, like, I'd hate that, but it would at least provide some sort of clarity as to like what, because Pecota gives them what, like a 12 to 15% chance of making the playoffs, including the wild card right now.
Yeah, like 13 was when I last checked.
So
Jason Castro is a free agent next year if you want to go like 180 degrees from your approach on framing from this offseason.
Oh, so isn't Castro basically like Tyler Flowers again?
Left-handed Tyler Flowers.
Okay, that's kind of cool.
it's
a change of pace.
Wilson Ramos is a free agent.
He might get paid.
Yeah, that's usually when you make the All-Star team and OPS like 900 as catching. It doesn't matter how slow you are.
Yeah.
He might want to spend the offseason stateside, but...
Oh, now I really want Wilson Ramos to steal a base before he retires, because on his career, he's 0 for 3.
Wilson Ramos would be good for no other reason than just, like, using him as a cudgel to bring back every nightmare every Twins fan has had since the Matt Capps trade.
Oh, that's true. We don't troll other teams enough the way they troll us.
We sign their guys after they're washed up, and they just laugh at us.
Yeah, and then they beat us when they're on the other team, and then you acquire them, and then they keep hemorrhaging wins the other direction.
Oh, did you know that Morneau had concussion problems? You weren't aware of that?
God. Oh, it would have been very... No, I'm swallowing that joke. I'll type it.
Weeders is a free agent, if he doesn't just pick up the qualifying offer again.
If you were in charge of the White Sox, like, what are you doing for the next 3 weeks when you know, with the trade deadline for, like, this year? And
I would be actively buying last month, but now I wonder, with a super clogged patch of the division and the wild card, where I have to outplay the Astros, Red Sox, and Blue Jays significantly, I have a high degree of difficulty to execute the next 2 weeks.
And for the millionth time in the last 8 years or whatever, you don't need all-star players to make big upgrades because you're rostering and giving huge amounts of playing time to guys who are basically the definition of a replacement level or worse.
You might need all-star upgrades if you want to outplay like the field by five games over the 10-week span.
That's very true. And unfortunately, that's partially a product of like waiting this long to do anything about your weaknesses. That's what kind of sucks about it.
You have an open DH slot. You need a left-handed bat.
Justin Morneau, baby.
Hitting coaches don't get paid that much. How much juice has Barry Bonds got in that bat? And, you know, just in general inject?
That would pull me back in so hard.
Finally, the washed-up acquisition that everyone can get behind.
What's amazing is you took this team and you just dropped an 800 OPS from a shortstop in, like, for free. And they're still just, like, running on fumes. Like, how many teams could you throw Tim Anderson's start on where they don't just, like, get, like, a nitrous injection and just start running over people?
To be fair.
Like, how many teams could just, like, if you just threw an 800 OPS at their shortstop, like, how much better would they be?
They did win 5 series in a row.
I know. It helped a ton. But I'm just like, it's like...
Then they lost to the Braves.
What sort of situation is this team in, right? Like, well, we threw an eight... We added from within an 800 OPS at shortstop. Our offense is still terrible and has, like, 3 other holes that are just, like, complete death spiral level disasters. Still.
I mean, I think having an all-star first baseman zap into, like, basically replacement level first baseman hasn't helped.
Is he even replacement level? I mean, his defense is quite poor.
Yeah. I mean, I think Fangraphs has him subbed. I don't know what we do. We, Baseball Prospectus.
I'm looking it up. This is good radio. They have him as a... He's a 1 warp. He's a 0.9 warp at the moment. Projected out to have 2 warp for the rest of the season. 2 more. So be basically at where he was last year for value.
True Average really likes power.
Yeah.
Like, True Average thinks Todd Frazier is having a great year.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that.
I mean,
Dingers are, power's awesome.
Who are we to question the stat calculation of our betters?
I mean, it still has him having a worse year than he had last year and the year before.
Well, yeah. An obvious that. Tim Anderson is a 278 true average, which is real good.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, he looks fine at short to me defensively.
Yeah, I mean, he's not super instinctual.
No.
But he's, at this point, just a superlative athlete.
Right. I mean, when I say he looks fine there, it's one of those things where, and, you know, I defer. These are people who know more than I do. And maybe he's just keeps improving because he's a freak athlete who was really raw, and you can literally see change month to month. But he doesn't look like a guy where you know you have an evaluator saying like, ah, this dude can't stay at short. Like that, I'm not seeing that, and I was hearing that from some people. Obviously, they saw him last year, the year before. You know, I think it's very possible that he's improved a lot in 2 years of pro ball.
It's also possible the White Sox can be kind of headstrong with what they see as the future for a player.
Well, they've had success improving defense for project players at tough positions. I mean, Flowers is like a pretty hilarious example of their organizational like strengths and weaknesses in a way.
He had a real weird thing with his swing.
Yeah, you could say that about a lot of White Sox hitters.
True.
That was the Greg Walker special.
I mean,
I love that story when Flowers was still in AAA and he was, you know, he'd been crushing the ball, and then Greg Walker like made some changes to his swing, and Flowers' OPS was like in AAA, crashed below like 500 for like a month, and then Flowers was like, "Yeah, screw this. I'm like it was publicly said. He was like, "Yeah, I tried what he said, and I'm not doing that anymore." And he immediately went back to crushing the ball. It was so like night and day, because normally with like the hitting coach performance batter, especially over small sample size, is just this like impenetrable mixture of luck and variance and how can you attribute causation to anything. Like, this was just so stark. It was so like Greg Walker thinks this will work. It does not. Stop doing it. It starts working. It was hilarious. It was hilarious in like a very fatalistic, macabre sort of way.
To be fair, if you see Flowers' swing right now, if you saw that and I am like a young player, you would try to fix that.
See, I don't know if his swing right now is what it looked like when he was when the description on him was, well, this dude's is going to have to play first base, but that's fine because his bat will play there. Like, that was his profile coming up. For those of you who don't, like, remember that, which is crazy.
He still is, like, he had huge raw power and like an advanced plate approach from like an early age. And I just think the fact that like he had the huge like butt movement that he has in his swing, where he's like crouching over and sticking out like his lower half all weird.
Yeah.
That probably just didn't get exploited very much because he kind of probably always saw his pitch at a lower level.
Yeah, and pitchers down there were probably terrified of him.
I mean, I think the failure is that they didn't give him something or didn't help him in a way where he was able to install what they wanted him to do.
I mean, that advanced plate approach was good for, like, no walk percentage above 6% in his 3 years as a starter for the team.
Yeah, I was really optimistic for the guy that Flowers was as a backup, being a regular presence in the lineup. Like, that guy, like, you think of the ideal hitter as, like, a 300, 400, 500 guy. Flowers seems like he's really destined to be a 200, 300, 400.
Which a catcher is, like...
great.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Especially given that his defense wound up being totally usable.
What was it, like 2012, when he's a backup? The game against the Mariners was just driving rain and just like kept dragging along until Kevin Millwood gave up like a go-ahead two-run bomb to Flowers, and then they immediately called it. It was like one of my favorite memories of that season.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was such bullshit.
The Mariners, and I'd love to do another podcast if we could get one of my Mariners friends on, because they play the Angels coming out of the All-Star break, and then they play the Mariners. The Mariners, I feel like, have been sort of the White Sox-like twin in suffering in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, 2005 separates the two, just these GMs and these regimes where they go on for years and years and years and years, playoff droughts. And, like, no farm system, no hitters developed, like, to speak of. The Mariners have thrown a lot more top 10 picks at position players and gotten pretty much just as much as the White Sox have out of their system on offense. There was that game. I guess the Mariners had their Mike Cameron 4-home-run game against the White Sox. I'll always remember the Brian Anderson 2-home-run game off Felix Hernandez.
I don't remember that.
Oh, he popped like 2 solo home runs.
Like, I know it happened, but I don't remember watching it.
Oh, it was hysterical. It made no sense.
What the hell?
Are they planning on having Zach Collins catch next year?
The major? I mean, he just got promoted to high A, and he played 3 terrible games in rookie ball.
Like, the worst possible games without getting hurt.
He got a hit. And he scored.
Did he?
Yeah. Oh. He got one hit, came around. Theoretically, if he scores a run every 11 plate appearances for the rest of his career, he'll be pretty fucking good. Actually, not really.
No. That's what, like 60 runs a year?
I did not... Man, this is why we have to have Ethan on here.
Dude, I did that for you. That's division. Don't lump me in on that. That's 600 divided by...
Well, typical shiny up Sox prospects.
I think most people liked the Collins pick, right?
Yeah, if not for the degree of inevitability about it, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been, you know, polished college bats who have turned out to be good investments in recent years. Like, it's a profile that can succeed.
He's basically a description of like Flowers as a prospect. Probably can't stick a catcher, advanced plate approach, big power, contact issues.
So he's going to be Drew Butera, right?
Basically.
Yeah. I'm really annoyed by the Birdie pick. Maybe
a skeptical reading could show that the White Sox just picked the first baseman and 2 relievers.
Yeah, I don't even think that's that skeptical. Isn't that the most likely outcome?
Yeah, and the way they're like rushing Birdie and not acquiring relief help, I mean, you never think that anyone's actually drafting for need. That, like, never happens. But, like,
you know, the last guy I can think of who did that was Bill Bavezzi. Like, Bill Bavezzi drafted Josh Fields with his first-round pick for the Mariners because he wanted him to, like, help their playoff push or something like that. And I don't – Bill Bavezzi, you know, always a good guy to model yourself after as a GM, right?
I heard he was a decent scout.
I don't even know what that means anymore. What does that mean?
He found a player once that wasn't terrible.
All right, so, like, I can separate out this process in my head of, you know, we have the 10, the 26, and the 47 or whatever in this draft, right? Like, we don't want to lose the draft pick because now we can have this super sweet draft. We'll have a big pool. The problem, so one of the things that happened this year with the draft is in years past, there have been like a couple of teams that had multiple high picks and huge pools, and they were able to play games with it. You know, like the Astros did a few times because they had 1-1 and maybe they had rolled, you know, like they had Bregman and they had the 2 and another top 10 pick, I think. Anyway, they've had several years like that. Maybe you lose a couple of free agents and you have a big pool and you can start playing games because there aren't a lot of other teams that can go over slot. Like, there's only a couple that you have to worry about, and so you can actually kind of plan about, like, sneaking guys through and doing cute stuff like that. This year, there were, like, a dozen teams that had, like, crazy huge pools. Because, like, the Reds had a huge one, the Padres had a huge one, and, like, three picks before the White Sox had their second. It was like the Braves. There were a ton of teams that had that. So, like, it wasn't as clear of this advantage. I mean, obviously, having more picks and more money is better. But, like, it wasn't this something you could exploit as hard. And at the same time, I'm sympathetic to, you know, maybe the guy we want at 26 doesn't get there, but we can't get him if we give up the pick at all, you know, right? So I understand there's, like, the opportunity cost if you give that pick up. But now that we're past it, now that they tried it that way instead of signing a free agent of consequence, and you're here with Zach Birdie, like, they signed Zach Birdie for, I think they signed all three of their top picks just for slot, right?
Right.
Just straight up. So, like, they didn't sign Birdie under and apply that money elsewhere.
If you think you're going to, like, lightning rush this guy to the majors and he's going to be making a major league salary in, like, a year or two, you'd hope that would maybe be an angle you could hit to bring his sign down.
But you can really analyze this because they didn't play any slot games with any of those three guys. You can really analyze this straight up as that pick is worth exactly Zach Birdie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And whatever the value of the opportunity of being able to survey the field at 26 and make a selection was, which is now in the past. So for a long time, it was easy to say, hey, this team, you know, like over the offseason, you had these sort of these arguments that I kept bumping my head up against when I was talking to people on Twitter and things like that, where they're like, well, they can always fix problems at the deadline, or, oh, well, they want that extra pick for the draft and they can do cool things at the draft. And at the time, it was all still speculative, right? But now we've seen this team had a real opportunity to put themselves in a great position, even without having made any further additions after Frazier and Laurie.
I mean, I guess your cool thing you could say that you did is you got Birdie, who I guess now has strung together consecutive good outings at Double A. So perhaps the idea of promoting him is not entirely ridiculous. So that's like your sure thing. He's going to be a solid, consistent reliever. Very exciting. First round pick. But that kind of opened you up to this extreme ultimate test of White Sox pitching development project with Hanson that you're able to take and not worry about, like, getting immediate value as much.
I don't really know. I don't really mind the Hanson pick that much at all, because it's like...
You're leaning on your strengths.
You're leaning on your strengths. I think that people, over, as a general principle, and now I'm not saying it doesn't actually apply to Hanson, I think as a general matter, people overrate recency. Like, there's a strong recency bias, and even when you're dealing with really small samples with very young players when it comes to the draft, you know, like, the fact that Hanson went from a 1-1 guy to 50th overall, and even then it's seen as like a reach by some people in a 6-month span, speaks to how volatile some of this can be. Well, and that
prospects are volatile.
I know. And I'm not saying that that's not valid, but I'm just, you know, like, we saw Rodon's stock drop, even though what looks, because like his velocity was down is the year before the White Sox drafted him and things like that. And like, clearly they were able to get, like, it was still in there. So I'm just saying, it's like, that was seemed like a worthwhile dice roll at that stage in the draft, right? Like, that's cool. That's fine. And maybe Birdie races to the majors, and, you know, relievers cost a lot of money. But at the same time, given that the White Sox never spend any money, I don't really care about them saving money because they don't use it. So
yeah, at some point, the big move that, like, there's no real point to, like, signing low-cost guys unless they're enabling something.
Yeah, I mean, like, great, you know, Sale and Quintana are worth, like, hundreds of millions of dollars more than you're paying them, but that hasn't manifested in the form of, like, actually using those savings on something meaningful elsewhere.
Right.
So who cares?
Some people. Maybe one person.
I think Carson Fulmer is much more likely, is like a much better bet to help out of the bullpen this year.
Yep.
Which is fine. I like guys breaking into the majors as relievers. I think it's a very valid way of doing things.
Not really worried about guys with big stuff working with Cooper getting stunted.
No. But you're, in terms of starting as a reliever, you're worried, right? You'd be worried about that stunting. I mean, that was how, like, that's an old method. Like, that's how Earl Weaver brought guys in, and, like, any number of ace starters now. I mean, obviously, Johan Santana, Chris Sale, David Price.
Right. I'm not saying the practice in general is problematic. I'm just saying this is not an organization worried about that. The Orioles, yeah, like, I just basically would probably fear for any pitcher, like, at any point where he's under contract with the organization.
There's nothing the Orioles could do with a pitcher in terms of his development right now where I wouldn't worry about him, just because of, like, their track record. Whether they're right or wrong, I would just be like, they're probably messing up.
I'm just waiting for whatever revelation we're going to get about what they've been doing to pitchers. Like, oh, we, like, cut their arms open like you would at, like, a chicken that you're sautéing to make sure the meat is done. I guess that's been hurting them.
I hadn't seen that Birdie's last couple starts were good at double, or appearances were good in double A.
Two good appearances. He's rolling.
I guess it's feasible that, you know, you've got Fulmer and Birdie up by, you know, August and September respectively.
I think it's feasible that, like, you bring up Birdie by September and he's better than Michael Yanoa is right now. I don't think it's feasible that, like, it's going to be like Zach Hu in a couple of weeks. Or I guess comparing Birdie to the odd damn guy who has the same first name. Zach,
yeah.
Button.
The one advantage Birdie has is he spells Zach with a K, which I think is advantageous as a pitcher.
I don't know if that comes through on the podcast that I'm talking about Putnam and not Birdie.
I guess he'll pronounce it as like Zach with Putnam from now on, or?
Yes. Putnam is now Yiddish.
No, I hear, but like, at the same time, the thing with Birdie is it's like he has great stuff. But like, you know, has great stuff. They're both like crazy raw. It's like this, it's kind of, it was interesting that you singled out Yanoa because it's like, well, I suppose it's a matter of degrees, but it's kind of, they're kind of the, like right now, I mean, if you brought Birdie up to the Major League pen, wouldn't you feel kind of the same way about him as you do about Yanoa? Where it's like, yeah, like he could go in there and blow people away if he knows where he's putting his pitches today.
Yeah,
but that's
much.
But that's a big if. I guess Birdie's got a couple extra ticks of velocity, but you know, has got an extra how many hundreds of innings of pro ball on him?
Mal called Yanoa, or he said Yanoa had like 30 pitchability the other day when I was talking to him about him.
Well, hopefully Birdie's better than that, but I would still lump them in the same bucket in terms of like major league utility right now. Maybe that's just my ignorance, but
no, I mean,
in terms of like their role of like leverage in the bullpen and what you can expect from them, I'd feel much more confident with Fulmer at that point.
Yeah, I mean, not tons, but if I had to rank them, probably Fulmer, Birdie, just because he has new car smell, and then Yanoa.
Yanoa's got pretty eyes, though.
He does. Almost a little too probing. Makes me uncomfortable.
They're adding a lot of pretty pitchers from outside of the organization, which is good.
I mean, that might get the fans in.
Hey, it's worth a shot. Maybe. Do you have any closing remarks for our loyal listeners?
I'm trying to think of notably ugly White Sox players.
That's a worthwhile endeavor. I'll hang up and listen. who's ugly?
Kelly Wunsch wasn't beautiful.
Well, for some reason, I keep thinking of that Houston reliever from 05, and I can't.
Brett Myers?
No, Ezekiel Estacio.
Oh God,
was that mean of me?
Yeah, I mean, he has whatever those issues are.
That was probably mean of me, huh?
I'm looking at old photos of Kelly Wunsch, and I think I picked the right guy.
Kelly Wunsch was like really good for a minute, right?
As like an extreme, either straight up sidearm or very low three-quarter lefty, who was very exclusively like a loogie, like. I think,
yeah.
I guess
he pitched in his rookie year. He pitched in 2000. He appeared in 83 games and pitched 61 innings.
Yeah, Jerry Manuel was disciplined about that.
Manuel did a lot of. Manuel had his virtues, that's for sure. The knock on Manuel would be his in-game moves left something to be desired, but that sounds kind of familiar. And Manuel actually has like a track record of grooming. Of sort of coaching up young position players.
Yeah, he was. That was also the era where like the White Sox couldn't get an out ever.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know how much of that's on Manuel though.
I'm just saying, like, there was. It's basically the flip of what things are now. So, yeah, they'll be new to go back to like hitting the shit out of the ball, and everyone on the starting staff has a 5 ERA, but wouldn't necessarily be better.
It's interesting the White Sox strengths and weaknesses seem to track with the leagues where like whatever their strength is less like valuable at the time. Where like, you know, where runs when scoring is down, it's like, the White Sox have all this pitching. It's like, well, yeah, most people have pitching now.
But that was like almost like to a T like, who they were like through the late 90s to early 2000s. And then it just flipped in 2005 like Ozzie was freaking Franklin Roosevelt or something.
Roosevelt?
Who flipped the parties?
Did he?
Didn't he?
Are you thinking of Lyndon Johnson?
No, I'm thinking of Franklin Roosevelt. He was a Democrat. Democrats were, you know, conservative until then.
That's true.
He was full of, like, you know, elevate the poor. Man, we're going to get so many angry New Deal comments in our freaking podcast, man.
Well, you know, par for the course, really. At least this time it'll make sense. When my readers yell at us about New Deal stuff, when I'm just saying that Nate Jones is good, then I get confused and angry. It'll be deserved now.
Can't wait to have comments about like the WPA did nothing. It was World War II.
Well, that was what I was taught. It was the Tennessee Valley Light and Power whatever program? I remember that one.
Among others. Seemed
interesting that a specific valley got singled out for special treatment, but, you know, good for them.
I don't know how to follow up that.
Oh, maybe it's for the best.
We were just riffing on the Tennessee Valley Water and Power Initiative.
I can't even remember what Tennessee. I'm Google Authority, whatever. Okay. Federally owned corporation created by congressional charter in May 1933 to provide navigation and flood control. Navigation? That's the first thing listed? Navigation of Tennessee. Didn't think that was an issue. Okay, so we're about to begin the second half. They get another opportunity to beat up on a garbage team in the form of the Angels. And then on to the Mariners. So, thoughts?
Kind of anxiety about going to the Angels and just having the possibility of Mike Trout just murdering us for a couple games and taking the series as a result.
Would it really bother you if they got murdered by Mike Trout, though? Like,
existentially, no, but like, it wouldn't be good for the.
No, it wouldn't be.
It wouldn't be good for traffic.
It wouldn't be good for the team. It's just, it's not the same thing as when like you lose 2 out of 3 to the Braves.
Yeah,
the Angels are the Braves plus Mike Trout.
Mike Trout clocking dingers is probably less annoying than Jeff Francoeur. I'll give him that.
And intentionally walking Jeff Francoeur. At least it was with a lefty this time.
At least, like, you know, Jeff Francoeur, like, crushes a mistake. Like, Chris Sale throws him, like, some tumbling changeup on, like, the black on the outer half, and Trout hits it 480 feet. That's kind of its own little annoying, don't you think?
I mean, it's annoying because, like, you want to win, but, like, I'm not going to... Like, there are times where the team screws up and it makes me really angry at, like, the team in the front office where it's like, this was avoidable. If you did your jobs better, we wouldn't be in this mess. But, like, getting beat by Trout, I mean, like, the All-Star game last year when Greinke threw that, like, evil slider at the knees off the plate on the outside corner and Trout just, like, clocked it to opposite field for a leadoff, like, home run. I was like, well, like, you did what you were supposed to do. Crowded on you, and that's okay. Like, I don't get upset when stuff like that happens.
There's a difference between having to tip your cap and then, like, questioning whether there's any sort of meritocracy in life.
Well, I don't mind, but there's a difference also between tipping your cap to Mike Trout and tipping your cap to Mike Foltynewicz or Dylan G or any number of other, like, you know, mediocrities that have absolutely eviscerated the White Sox lineup this year.
Well, Flowers said that Foltynewicz had, like, the best stuff he's ever seen, which I'm totally sure wasn't, like, some jaded ex-lover shade thrown at Chris Sale or something.
All right, Foltynewicz is a bad example because he's always had good stuff. It's just a matter of locating. So if on a given day he is actually locating, you shouldn't be miserable about you know, whatever your own input was to the result.
10 strikeouts.
But yeah, that was poor. That was not good. Didn't they strike out like 15 times against Colin McHugh and the Astros relievers?
Yeah, but I think they won that game.
They did.
So that's a good method.
So they get Angels, Seattle.
That's how you figure out what process is right, by watching the results, Nick.
No. People yell at me for criticizing the White Sox process, and then their results have also been terrible for like a decade. So I don't know how I can win. Then we get 4 games against Detroit, 4 games against the Cubs. They could be 6 under by the time they roll into the trade deadline and playing Minnesota.
Yeah, the odds of the Cubs still being in the funk for another 2 weeks is I don't want to bet on it.
No. So there's 17 games between now and the trade deadline. 6 of those games are against terrible teams. And then 11 of those are against very good ones. Good to very good. And we'll see. I remember Han last year was saying when they didn't make any moves, he was like, well, those trades take like a long time to put together. And so even with that winning streak, it was, like, too late for us to do anything. So what? Like, are they going to start putting moves together and then go 1-7 against the Tigers and Cubs? And think it'll all be irrelevant anyway?
I don't really buy that. I mean, theoretically, he's having these discussions all the time. So, yes, they technically probably take a while to get together, but I'm sure all the background conversations and evaluations and if I'm assuming Han has already probed what people want for certain players to some degree.
That's obviously those deals can come together really quickly. They have to. Otherwise, like, the trade deadline itself wouldn't really be the flurry of activity that it is.
Yeah, he's not like on July 28th calling up Oakland like, "Hi, I'm Rick. Is this Billy? I'm the GM for the White Sox."
Well, who's the...
What do you think of Tyler Danish?
Am I supposed to come in and improvise as David Force now, or do you want to just keep doing this as a one-man show?
David, this phone number says Billy. Put Billy on the phone.
Now, I know we swindled you a couple times, David, but hear me out. I was looking up how well Mark Tim Anderson was doing sort of league-wide as far as just hitting as a shortstop goes.
Probably not as good as Semien.
Not as good as Semien. Not even close.
I can't wait to how slurred that crazy yelling just now was going to be in the recording.
No, it came through.
Probably not as good as Semien.
The emotion definitely came through. yeah. Some of that's park factors, but
19 bombs.
Yeah,
in Oakland.
Yep.
I mean, he does lead the league in games played. It was 89. So.
So there's a couple weeks left. We've seen some teams sort of like, who are hovering around, definitively crash out in the last like few weeks. Like the Rays for a couple months were at the periphery of doing a thing, and then they had like an L10 and an L6, I think. And they're just like done. I'm trying to think. Like the Angels and A's were in it for like a little while, you know, from counting from the beginning of the season, and then they've both pretty definitively been knocked out at this point. But the Phillies, I suspect, like, they don't have anybody to sell because they either have like garbage or, you know, like someone young that they're building around. I mean, I don't like, that's why this, I hate this freaking, like, we'll fix it the deadline thing, because like the market's not conducive to what they want, even though what they want is just a bat, any bat, for the love of God, a bat. Like, there still isn't that much out there.
You think any team has had an L7 concert while on an L7?
I'm sure this joke would land better with somebody who knows who L7 is.
Freaking 90s Riot Girl punk band.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everyone. Sorry to all of our L7/White Sox fans out there. I'm sure there's a lot of overlap.
I don't know who would get this joke currently on staff. Maybe Kat.
Colin might?
Might.
I'll ask. Anyway, they could also rip off like 8 out of 10 wins and add Josh Reddick and a couple relievers, and all of a sudden that looks like a real team. But
not seeing it.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing is, like, they didn't have to do too much. They didn't have to add anybody crazy to make big improvements on the team. But like, they haven't done it yet. It's like, why would I expect them to do it now? Like, for a normal team it would be very attainable, but this isn't a normal team, so but
I don't like, they have to outplay like a lot of teams by a lot that are like better than them right now. Like, they're not like on equal footing with teams that need to outplay them. Like, I don't want to say, like, it's hard with the core of, like, Sale and Quintana to say, like, you need to sell, and, like, they don't really have, like, things to sell that they won't immediately need next year if they're trying to win next year. I just don't know what they do. Other than just keep adding and hope that your team is stronger next year.
The other problem is, even if you're selling, like, Sale, if you're doing a fire sale, maybe you trade one of Sale and Quintana. Because, like, the odds of in season there being like two teams who can put together, right? I mean, am I crazy that there'd be like the odds? It's almost impossible to get fair value for either of them. The idea of getting fair value for both is like crazy.
Yeah, I could see. I mean, maybe keeping like, one, but they're both, they're not Julio Teheran where they're 25. They're both 27.
They're both under control for what, 3 more years?
I don't know. It's so muddled with all those team options.
Yeah, the White Sox have team options, like cheap team options on Quintana through 2020.
Yeah.
Like $10 million a year or something like that. And Sale has team options for through 2019.
Well, there you go.
So I guess it's not crazy to think that they could put something together in that time frame, but it's just frustrating because like they've spent so many years doing these half measures that you're just sitting in this like this no man's land for like all of these two guys' 20s.
I think you do the Rangers plan, except the part where you don't like luck into a still winning the title that year, where you just try to make the major league team better. But you know, maybe you can swing a major trade, but they probably don't have the prospects to pull like a Cole Hamels. But try to add, because you still have to keep this core together. Because I don't know, you probably have like 1 or 2 more years where you can really, I mean, optimistically that Abreu holds up, even if he kind of recovers to like an 800 OPS guy.
Well, you only have 1 more year before you start needed to like plug a ton. Like you have 1 more year with Melky, Frazier, and Laurie. And right. those guys aren't a big deal to most teams, but like those, that even just getting those guys who are like average to above average at their positions is so hard for this freaking organization that like after 2017, you're in like, all of a sudden, you're in real trouble with like a 30-year lineup again, just at those three spots. Because I don't like, who's the internal replacement for those guys? Like Mikulchevsky and what?
Mikulchevsky will never be as good as Todd Frazier.
No,
close.
I know, but I'm saying like even getting somebody who can play like a league average third base.
Yeah. Trace Thompson's still in the system, right?
Yeah, I don't think he's ever going to put it together.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, you're going to have... This is the problem. You add two guys every offseason with, like, a mid-level free agent or a trade, and then, you know, lo and behold, another couple, like, positions come up, and you have nothing internally to fix it. I mean, I guess you may have... the shortstop may be solved for, like, a number of years now, which is fantastic, but, you know, there's still the other... You know, 4 or 5 spots that you're gonna have to figure out, and after 2017, because I still don't see those guys in the system. Even if you say Collins is your next first baseman to take over for Abreu, as Abreu fades into being like a DH, like an okay DH, maybe.
Right.
Like okay, like let's just say that works in for 2018, right? Like Collins is polished. It's not crazy to think he could open the year in 2018 with the team, right? Like give him 2 years in the minors, year and a half in the minors.
It is not enough to have you committed on its own.
But like, right? No, you'd have to look to other. You'd have to provide other evidence that I should be.
Yeah, but Jane would really have to, you know, just damning testimony.
Oh, she could do it. Like that wouldn't even be hard. It would, the only hard part would just be like, you know, convincing her to do it. But once you did, like it'd be a breeze. It's scary. Like it's really scary. Like you do have Quintana and Sale for years, but like at a certain point too, I mean, they're not guaranteed to hold this level of performance over those years either. Like you might finally cobble together a supporting cast that could win with this Quintana and Sale by 2018, 2019, but by then Quintana and Sale are diminished.
Yeah. I'd have to say, like, Han has just acquired, like, the guys he used to acquire Brett Laurie, I didn't even, like, have in my mind as trade chips.
Right.
Like,
right.
If you asked me, like, what the White Sox had to sell, like, I wouldn't have even thought of them.
I mean, if you can keep doing that, if you could trade like Jordan Stevens or something for like another league average infielder, like
that'd be nice. Okay,
you know, great, fantastic. But here's the thing though, if you could just do that, what, like, how the hell is Avi still got the sixth most PAs on the team? That's what scares me, is either they're unwilling to upgrade him, they're unable to upgrade him, or they went this whole time thinking that he didn't need to be upgraded. And you can take your pick as to which is like the scariest. I think the last one's probably the scariest scenario in terms of how they're going to do moving forward. But like, there's no way you can slice this where it isn't humiliating and a total indictment of their entire organizational process for the last at least 5 years that this is where they're at with him.
Having like the big trade return of your 2013 teardown be useless is not good.
I think it's would have been fair to even say at the time that Montas may have been a better prospect.
I mean, he wasn't more highly regarded.
No.
I mean, there wasn't any semblance of command, I thought, at that point.
Was Avi ever like a top 100 guy?
Like 70s.
He was a 74 BA before 2013 once. I think Montas has topped that.
He has topped that since, but I don't know if he was that already.
Well, yeah, he was younger.
Right.
He was in the 90s twice from MLB.com. So I guess, but like, I don't know. I've never thought Avi was going to work. And I'm not just saying that now.
I know. You wanted him to get Iglesias.
Well, like, I didn't see that deal before it happened, right? Like, I knew they were going to shop Peavy somewhere. I remember following it that they were shopping only to teams that would take 100% of the deal because, you know, got to save all that money so you can not spend it later. But, like, when that deal did happen, like, it was clear that there was – the primary deal was the Red Sox wanted Peavy, right? That's, like, what initiates that whole deal happening. And the Red Sox sent Montas, Wendelken, and Cluey Louie, I think, to the White Sox.
Yes.
And the Tigers got brought in because presumably the White Sox wanted Avisaíl instead of Iglesias. Because it doesn't make a difference to the Red Sox, right? Like, they're shipping out Iglesias one way or the other.
Right.
They're just shipping it to the Tigers instead of the White Sox. They don't care.
Basically, the Tigers' only function in that trade is giving up Avisaíl so they can get Iglesias.
Yes. Unless you care about Brian Villarreal or something like that. I can't even remember the guy's name. I don't think he was considered to be anything of consequence at the time, and he certainly hasn't turned out to be.
He was a reliever who could throw the ball extremely hard and had a very good year in 2012. Wasn't any good before that and wasn't any good afterwards.
And that trade happened in 2013, so he had a crappy 2013 at the time, right?
Very, very bad 2013.
So, oh, and he spells Brian really weird. I knew there was something with that.
He's from Venezuela.
That's okay. Weird is fine. But like,
I'm pretty sure they just saw his name and they were like, "Oh, this is Brian. You're Brian." And he was just like, "Fine."
Brian. Is there any other conclusion to draw from that other than the White Sox, that the Red Sox were like, "Well, you could have Iglesias," and they were like, "No, we're much more interested. Like, we don't want that.
Let's get Detroit involved and let's get Avi."
Right. Like, that's what this says to me.
Yeah, and they really wanted him. And
it's terrifying that that's how that went down. Especially, like, I know that Avisaíl Viseado comps are lazy. But
because Viseado could hit for power.
They're not, like, they weren't, it isn't that lazy, though. Like, they had the same problems that they had to overcome. And you had just failed ignominiously with Viseado, and now you're like signing up for the same experience. I don't know what they thought they had learned from that. And obviously, Iglesias turned out to be a better hitter than it looked like he would in the minors. You know, at the time of the trade, he had had this like really hot BABIP fueled first half. But
he's not covering himself in glory this year.
But he's like a top three or four in the majors defensive shortstop, isn't he?
That's a fair argument.
I saw people saying he was 1A to Simmons, and I guess that would be before like guys like Lindor and stuff came up too. But and that was a few years ago. But
if you're on the train of Jose Iglesias can't hit, you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself right now.
But a 640 OPS from an elite glove at short who's like cheap as hell is a totally viable thing to have.
Right.
Certainly much more use. I mean, his... You're saying this is the... Oh, wait. Don't, let's... Hold on. Hold on. I just want to confirm. Pretty sure. Okay, so this is your proof that Iglesias can't hit year?
Yes.
His OPS is...
Oh, no!
...higher than Avisaíl's.
Has he homered since May 28th?
He's homered three times this year, so give me a sec. But he's basically the same...
He's homered five.
He's got the same bat as Avisaíl, but he's an elite glove at short. Mm.
He's Jose Iglesias homered since May 28th.
Yeah, June 28th. It's a whole month more recently.
Yeah.
So like that's like, and maybe if the White Sox got Iglesias instead of the Tigers, his OPS is 400. But like, because that seems to be their MO. But oh, and Iglesias' second middle name is Ailman. Like the beer. It's like a really interesting superhero.
I am willing to put down a few dollars that that's not how that's pronounced.
I'm not taking that back because I agree with you. But it's spelled that way. Anyway, that drives me crazy. That drives me absolutely crazy.
It's not good.
And, like, do you even want this front office being the ones figuring out the return you'd get if you did do a fire sale? Like, let's say Jerry was like, I'm done with this. I'm done with winning 78 games or whatever and never making the playoffs. I gave you guys way more slack than anybody else would have ever given you. You know, you did some good stuff, but you did much more bad stuff. And, you know...
Presuming that Jerry is not a big influence on the way they operated the last 5 years already. But yeah, in general, if I'm going to do a huge teardown, why am I not just doing a wholesale, like, reshaping of the organization?
And you might be better off trading, let's say you decide you want to trade Sale and Quintana, right? Let's just say you do. That's something you want to do in the offseason anyway, right?
If I'm doing a Wrath of God teardown? Yeah, I guess so. Like you maybe keep one of them?
You don't have to do that like in the next 2 weeks, though. Like people are going to go like absolutely nuts for those guys whenever you do it.
Right. I probably would trade Sale and...
I'd probably keep Quintana.
Just because he's longer and I figure I have more time to kind of wait out a huge bounty.
And I don't know, for years people have been saying that, you know, enjoy Sale what you can. And obviously they've been wrong to date. But Colin said that Quintana's, like, when he was reporting, he was saying that Quintana is absolutely shredded, by the way. Like, that guy is in crazy good shape.
Can't confirm.
Seems like, his delivery is, like, really clean and easy.
Mao called them last night the best two deliveries in the game.
Oh, Quintana?
Quintana and Sale.
Oh, interesting. Because people have been hating Sale's delivery for forever.
Focusing on footwork.
Oh, that's cool. I kind of want to ask Mao a lot more questions now. But, yeah. I mean, I love them both. I think they're both great. Super controversial opinions, but... in this hypothetical scenario, I think you could get more for Sale, and I think Quintana's, like, safer?
Yeah, I just wouldn't want to move them all both at once. I guess I wouldn't want to dilute my own market.
I don't want to move them at all. I'd rather just sign, like, Cespedes and Fowler and, like, kicked everyone's brains in this year.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
And, like, I don't care that you lost Zach Birdie for that. And, oh, no, you run at $140 million payroll instead of $115 for once. and you have the 10th biggest salary in the majors once, and you could actually win. Like, with those two dudes, like, this team could have won like 90 plus games easy.
Perchance. Be better than they are right now.
Better than they are right now.
Clearly right, buyers, Saints. Clearly within range. Yeah.
I'm going to watch some bok choy for dinner.
Vegetables, gross.
Well, they're going to go with the pork chops.
Oh, right. Well, okay.
But I don't need to wash the pork chops.
I always wash my pork chops.
That's why...
Two trips in the dishwasher.
That sounds like it might be upper tier cuisine for Elkhart.
Yeah, some only do one.
Oh man, I hope our listeners appreciate you as
some
much
just,
as I do.
Some just boil off the impurities off over the meth beaker.
Hopefully not while they're crashing their pickup truck into some sort of withering mom and pop establishment.
A veterinarian's office.
Oh, look at all right, Primiano. You heard it here first. It's like Final Destination. Look out. Primiano may be one of the few people who's going to make it this far in the cast.
Yeah, just out of commitment to find something awful.
Great website. All right, night, bud.
See you later. Bye.